Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The last 2 years of farm income were, in fact, a record set of years.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
Nearly 50% of our farmers did not make any money at all in those record years. In fact, they lost money. Another almost 40% of our farmers made money, but the majority of money they made came from off-farm income. So in record years, nearly 90% of our producers either didn't make or did not make the majority of the money that they need. We have got to figure out how we can create more revenue streams for farmers, particularly those small and mid-sized producers. We've got to figure out ways in which we can extend beyond the traditional role of farmers benefiting from the sale of crops and livestock to figuring out additional ways in which that farmstead can generate profit so that they have multiple streams.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We are focused on responding to the direction in the Growing Climate Solutions Act to provide a report to this committee by August of 2023.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack testifying recently before the Senate Ag Committee.
And we are in the process of putting together the team that will essentially do the groundwork surrounding that report. We will also be looking at and doing a review of the existing carbon market system today. I think we're going to learn a great deal from the 141 projects that we're funding under the Climate Smart Ag and Forestry Commodity Partnership Initiative, because many of those initiatives are also establishing and working on trying to maintain and support a variety of markets, not just carbon markets. There are roughly 24 regulated markets. Or not regulated markets, 24 markets that exist today that we can take advantage of with climate smart practices. Carbon markets are one of them, water markets, biodiversity markets, a whole variety of markets. And so this is a strategy, I think, which is important, and we want to get it right. But to get it right, we have to understand where things are today, and then we have to determine whether or not there need to be improvements and how we would at USDA ensure that farmer participation in these markets is appropriate. I would say one last comment, which is that we have to make sure that they are farmer-friendly, that they are usable by farmers. Many of the carbon markets that exist today are not really structured for farmers. They're structured for investment banks and so forth, and that doesn't really work very well in the countryside.
While there is some bipartisan support for that program, Iowa Senator Joni Ernst reminded the secretary.
I hear a lot about the so-called Inflation Reduction Act and how a lot of how that was written really reads like the Green New Deal. And as we're looking at the Farm Bill, we want to make sure that what we're doing in the Farm Bill is actually working with our farmers, with our ranchers, for their benefit, not the folks on the far left on the coasts of the United States. This is about middle America and providing food necessary for the greater population. We know that this administration is focused heavily on green energy, which on its own, that's great, but there is such an ardent push towards electric vehicles that, and you know how I feel about ethanol, that we have this ready-made available resource in the Midwest that's cheaper. It's a cheaper energy solution than some of the proposals such as the electric vehicles. And we really feel that it deserves full attention. So I know ethanol biodiesel is not, it doesn't fall under the jurisdiction of this particular committee, but it is something that is very beneficial for our farmers. The president has been very insistent on returning to a number of harmful, overreaching regulations. And again, as I'm out across every one of my counties, and you know those counties very well, every one of those counties, when I do a town hall, when I do a farmer roundtable, WOTUS always comes up. And here we are returning to the Obama-era regulations of waters of the U.S. And it doesn't matter what group it is, farmers, small business owners, county secondary roads personnel, they are all just very upset about WOTUS regulations, and they feel they haven't been heard. So folks are struggling, Mr. Secretary. They're struggling in Iowa. They're spending more. They're getting less, and especially in the most rural of our communities.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The report was largely in line with expectations.
Caitlin McCulloch is Director, Livestock Marketing Information Center, on the latest USDA Cattle on Feed report.
Placements in February were down about 7%. Marketings were about 95% of a year ago, which gives us an on-feed number for March 1 at about 4% below a year ago. So not necessarily too exciting. That was very in line with pre-report expectations and where we are in the cattle cycle today. One of the more interesting pieces of the Canadian cattle on feed report, which actually gets released a month earlier, is their numbers are declining just like U.S. numbers are, but they actually release a heifer number every single month, whereas the U.S. only releases it quarterly. And so from the Canada data, what we can tell is that heifers are still going on feed at a very high volume, and over 800 pounds was 46% higher than a year ago last month in terms of placements. And the other big category to increase was the under 600 pounds of placements for heifers on feed, and that was up 82% from a year ago. And so there doesn't seem to be a lot of heifer retention happening in Canada either. And so collectively, between the two countries, right now we're looking at cattle on feed inventories collectively down about 625 or so thousand head. And it doesn't appear that we're going to be changing that picture anytime soon in either country.
So what do these numbers really tell us?
So what it means is that we are very unlikely to grow cattle supplies anytime soon. Both countries are really focused on drought. In Canada, it's really centering around the two larger cattle provinces of Saskatchewan and Alberta. In the U.S., it's along that Great Plains corridor, so again, over cattle country. And so that's going to make it very difficult for us to retain heifers and increase breeding stock and thereby increase in cattle supplies in the future. And so we're just looking at smaller and smaller cattle supplies moving forward.
What about some other concerns?
It was a choppy week on the futures market. Live cattle ended the week last week down a little bit in the summer contracts, but a little bit up in April in some of the more deferred contracts. On the feeder cattle side, we also ended the week down in the nearby contracts and a little bit higher in some of those more deferred contracts. But it was a relatively wild week. The big news more broadly is that we've had two larger regional banks collapse here in the U.S., and consumers, the stock market, and even the commodity markets are a little bit nervous about what that means and if it's going to be contained or we're facing some sort of systemic risk. And that's what the Federal Reserve is going to be looking at as they look to make a decision about rates in the coming week. And probably one of the bigger moves, cattle seemed to escape relatively unscathed, but the lean hog futures lost about $10 a hundredweight last week from Tuesday on. And so some big market moves, largely, I think, in response to both that nervousness, and then there was a little bit of news about ASF in China and some rumors about some disease pressure that I think shook that market pretty hard.
The bottom has dropped out of the hog market. Can that happen here?
I don't know if it'll happen to that extent just because cattle supplies are so much tighter, but there is this question of, does this economic turmoil lead to a decline in demand, which could impact particularly live cattle prices over the summer? Another thing that's hard to guess at this is what timing. So there was some conversations about the ripple effect in this banking event causing problems in Europe. Does it come back to the U.S., you know, in 6 months or something as something else and another consequence we weren't expecting? And so the big risk, I think, for the cattle side of things is going to be, does it shake demand this summer?
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I'm going to put one issue on the table for you all to consider.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack testifying at a USDA oversight hearing in front of the Senate Ag Committee.
The last 2 years of farm income were, in fact, from a net cash income perspective, a record set of years. Never before in the history of the country have we had net farm cash income at the level we've had the last couple of years. And as the chairwoman indicated, we anticipate and expect above average net cash farm income this year, notwithstanding many of the challenges that Senator Bozeman outlined accurately. The challenge, however, is this. Nearly 50% of our farmers did not make any money at all in those record years. In fact, they lost money. Another almost 40% of our farmers made money, but the majority of money they made came from off-farm income. So in record years, nearly 90% of our producers either didn't make any money or did not make the majority of the money that they need to represent their families. Now, this is not a small versus large situation. This is a situation where 90% of our farmers need help. And I think if we are truly interested in making sure that they get help while respecting the important role that large commercial-sized operations play in providing the productivity that this country needs and the world needs, and if we're truly concerned about the hollowing out, as Senator Bozeman has indicated, he is, and I believe he is, and I am too, of rural America, the important part of America, we have got to figure out how we can create more revenue streams for farmers, particularly those small and mid-sized producers. We've got to figure out ways in which we can extend beyond the traditional role of farmers benefiting from the sale of crops and livestock to figuring out additional ways in which that farmstead can generate profit so that they have multiple streams. This is not a new issue. I brought with me the first report of the Commission of Agriculture that was published in 1863, the first year of the department's history. In it, Commissioner Isaac Newton, not the real Isaac Newton, different fella, had an interesting preface to the 632-page report in which he talked about the importance of focusing on making sure that we had small, mid-sized, and large-scale farming operations. So we've had this issue since 1863. Secretary Berglund, in 1979, issued a warning to all of us about the potential opportunity for exactly what we're talking about here today. So this has been with us for a while. And fortunately, because of the passage of the American Rescue Plan, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, and the Inflation Reduction Act, we now are in a position to create seed money, if you will, for the establishment of multiple ways of farmers to profit from the farm besides and in addition to the sale of crops and livestock, which will provide more hope and opportunity for small and mid-sized producers and will create an entrepreneurial spirit, which I think will be able to allow small communities to attract young people back for an opportunity to expand and increase the population. So I'm excited about this. I want to work with the committee to ensure that as you're crafting this farm bill, that we address this issue, because I think it's an important one, and I think it has a rippling effect.
Member of the Senate Ag Committee from Kansas, Dr. Roger Marshall, questioning Vilsack.
Before the Eighth Circuit, attorneys for the Justice Department suggested that USDA are not experts on the uses of pesticides. They use this argument to try to convince the Eighth Circuit judges to ignore a letter you sent to former Representative Hartzler and members of Congress standing by the science of pesticides. Specifically, as your department is working with USTR to end the GMO ban by Mexico, do statements like these harm your efforts to advocate for American farmers?
It makes it difficult because it creates confusion.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
U.S. pork exports to the Dominican Republic reached new heights last year and haven't missed a beat in 2023. U.S. Meat Export Federation Regional Representative Lucia Ruano says consumer education efforts funded by USDA and the National Pork Board have helped bolster demand for U.S. pork.
Dominican Republic is our major market at this moment in the region, and for us, education is key. We are trying to teach everyone that pork is for the center of the plate, that is not only an ingredient to make processed products, and people are starting to enjoy the versatility of the products, and now they have the availability of these products, not only in supermarket, but also in these meat boutiques, little stores that have premium cuts. They also have side dishes, the charcoal, the wine, the beer, and it's very easy for them to step in the store and make a meal.
Pork demand has also benefited from a rapid rebound in tourism.
Before the pandemic, they were working on this plan to get 10 million tourists in a year. And in 2019, they had around 7.4 million. And then came the pandemic. And they started doing a very good job last year in promoting local and international tourists. And they closed 2022 with 8.4 million tourists during the year.
The DR's domestic pork industry is still struggling with African swine fever.
it's going to be difficult to eradicate African swine fever over there because they have around 400 producers that have biosecurity standards, but there are around 20,000 producers that raise backyard pigs. So it's still affecting them. Their production has declined for more than 30%, and it is expected that their production keeps decreasing in 2023.
I'm John Harris.
Thanks, John. Okay, so let's move from exports to harvest now, and something known as Harvest for All.
Farm and ranch families from across the nation donated 25.3 million pounds of food and raised more than $1 million to help fight hunger in 2022 through Farm Bureau's Harvest for All program. AFBF Young Farmer and Rancher Chair Matt Feynman says the program helps community food banks.
Harvest for All is a partnership with AFBF Young Farmers and Ranchers and local food charities. So we provide food to people in need around the United States. It could be rural, it could be urban, but basically it's an opportunity for our state farm bureaus and our county farm bureaus to work together with food charities and be able to make a positive impact.
Feynman says the program helps ensure Americans who are facing food insecurity can have access to nutritious food.
This is a great opportunity and so important because as farmers and as ranchers, we have a mission to feed America, to feed the people. And this is an opportunity for us to do it directly, to be able to donate, whether it be food or whether it be volunteer hours, and continue to make that impact, to make it one-on-one and have that close contribution.
He adds the work farmers and ranchers provide for the program highlights the spirit of Farm Bureau.
From a personal perspective, it is truly amazing to see what these county farm bureaus and these state farm bureaus do in the time they put into it and the sacrifices they make to take that ongoing step to ensure that they're making an impact within their community. And it shows the compassion and the drive that people have within this organization to make a positive impact.
Learn more at FB.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
Again, that program through the American Farm Bureau Federation is Harvest for All. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Every year this week, we have what we title National Agriculture Day.
Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley.
Iowa's 86,000 families work hard each day to produce the food, fiber, and fuel for the rest of America. You all know that farmers make up less than 2% of our population, yet through their hard work, they provide for the other 98%. I will continue to work each day so farmers of all sizes have a seat at the table when it comes to the farm bill and other important bills that impact our farmers. One example of a bill I'm going to introduce this week is called the Next Generation Fuels Act. The bill was in last session and didn't get passed. The Next Generation Fuel Act would establish a minimum research octane number. It would be 98 for gasoline, which is much higher than the typical octane of 91. It also requires the added octane value to reduce carbon emissions by at least 40% compared to regular gasoline. This means higher blends of ethanol will be required. We know Americans will continue to rely on gasoline and internal combustion engine for decades to come, regardless of this administration's push for electric vehicles. My bipartisan bill will allow consumers to continue to use the cars they now drive and do it in a way that has lower carbon and lower cost fuel. And it will also expand the ethanol market for America's biofuel producers. Iowa's number one in ethanol production, and 43,000 jobs are at stake. It's going to enhance that industry tremendously.
But why is it so important to take a day or a week to recognize farmers and ranchers?
It's when we go to the supermarket and we buy almost anything we want. And when we sit down, we don't have to worry about having food at the table. And we have government programs that fill in for those that maybe don't have the money to buy what they need for an adequate diet. And all this comes from the farms of America. And it's something that has two aspects, as far as I'm concerned, that are very important and not talk about. One is food is national security issue as much as it is a food security issue, because you got to be able to feed your military if you're particularly if you're in battle. And secondly, there's an old saying that we're nine meals away from a revolution. In other words, if you couldn't feed your family for three full days and didn't know where you're going to get it on the fourth day, you'd take almost any action you could take, including maybe rioting to get the food, because we have rioting in other countries, particularly where rice is short or rice is very high expenditure. So it proves that if you want to have a social cohesion and peaceful society, the abundance of food is very important.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
With regard to the IPEF, the administration is very clear that IPEF will not include market access initiatives. Given that the administration wants to raise our trading partners' labor and environmental standards through IPEF, with which I don't disagree, why take the carrot of market access off the table?
1 year ago, Senate Finance Committee held a hearing with the Trade Ambassador, Katherine Tai, Senator Mike Crapo from Idaho, asking about the Indo-Pacific framework.
So I appreciate this opportunity to talk a little bit more about the approach that we are contemplating and consulting with all of you on with respect to the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. It is true that market access, strictly speaking as a trade terminology, is not on the table at this time in the framework. But I want to distinguish between what we mean by market access in trade vocabulary versus market access in ordinary English. Market access, as we talk about it in trade discussions and negotiations, typically means tariff liberalization. And that is true. We are not starting these conversations with tariff liberalization, in large part because our traditional trade models and traditional FTAs have led us to a place where we are facing a considerable backlash that we are listening to from our own people about concerns regarding the offshoring and outsourcing of American jobs and opportunities through these types of arrangements. That does not mean, however, that we are not bringing an economic engagement to this region that does not have economically meaningful outcomes. So in the sense of market access in ordinary English, which is to enhance our access to each other's markets, that is very much a part of what we are doing. In terms of the high labor and environment standards, I really want to thank you for affirming your commitment to the standards in U.S. Trade policy practice, because that is exactly the kind of practice that we want to bring to our trading partners in order to counteract those forces that have tended to bleed out our industries to other regions. We would like to use trade to raise standards around the world, to raise standards to the standards that we have here so that we can all enjoy the kinds of lives and opportunities that we would like.
Well, I understand, and as I said, I agree with that, but I define market access as free trade agreements. And I just don't see why we cannot engage in developing. And we've got nations in the Indo-Pacific who are crying out for free trade negotiations with us so that they can strengthen their relationship to us economically rather than being tied to China. And so I just want to state that I believe that we need to engage on free trade negotiations in terms of market access and not define market access as some kind of a framework or something else.
Frustration 1 year ago from both sides of the aisle. Maria Cantwell from Washington.
I don't find where we are, and we had a conversation with you, a roundtable discussion with our members, and you said, well, we're trying to reset the table here with China. So we gave you more time. And now we're here and we're hearing this focus that we're not saying that opening market access and getting rid of tariffs is a priority. And that's what the people in my state want to hear. As a very trade-dependent state, they want to know that we are fighting to increase market access. When you think about wheat, when you think about potatoes, when you think about some of these other products, it's more than 70% of the product is an export market. And when you look at the impacts of the 301 tariffs and how bad apples have been hurt, we want resolution to these issues.
Frustration continues to mount among ag organizations for a lack of a clear trade agenda. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
As lawmakers craft the new farm bill, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack suggests they focus not only on strengthening traditional farm safety net programs and crop insurance, but also
market development. Domestic market opportunities for small and mid-sized operators.
Vilsack told the Senate Ag Committee Thursday that as good as the current farm safety net programs are,
we are still losing a lot of our small and mid-sized farming operations. And so one way we can maybe prevent that is by having those small and mid-sized operations have more than a couple of ways to make money, more than just selling their crop or their livestock or a government payment.
Anything from producing climate-smart commodities to earning money through carbon markets to doing further processing of their products on their own farms. Vilsack said this would not only help farmers, but also would slow down or maybe reverse the exodus of population from the nation's rural communities. Gary Crawford, Washington.